fondly. He could not have loved a son more deeply. Jonathan was the one thing in life that gave him sheer, unadulterated joy. The child ran around the priory like a puppy, petted and spoiled by all the monks. To most of them, he was just like a pet, an amusing plaything. But to Philip and Johnny, he was something more. Johnny loved him like a mother, and Philip, though he tried to conceal it, felt like the boy's father. Philip himself had been raised from a young age by a kindly abbot, and it seemed the most natural thing in the world for him to play the same role with Jonathan. He did not tickle or chase him the way the monks did, but he told him Bible stories and played counting games with him, and kept an eye on Johnny. He went into the room, smiled at Johnny, and sat on the bench with the imaginary schoolboys. "Good morning, Father," Jonathan said solemnly. Johnny had taught him to be scrupulously polite. Philip said, "How would you like to go to school?"
"I know Latin already," Jonathan boasted.
"Really?"
"Yes, listen. Omnius pluvius buvius tuvius nomine patri amen."
Philip tried not to laugh.
"That sounds like Latin, but it's not quite right. Brother Osmond, the novice master, will teach you to speak it properly."
Jonathan was a little cast down to discover that he did not know Latin after all. He said,
"Anyway, I can run fast and fast. Look!"
He ran at top speed from one side of the room to the other.
"Wonderful," said Philip. "That really is fast."
"Yes,
and I can go even faster."
"Not just now,"
Philip said.
"Listen to me for a moment.
I'm going away for a while."
"Will you be back tomorrow?"
"No, not that soon."
"Next week?"
"Not even then."
Jonathan looked blank. He could not conceive of a time farther ahead than next week. Another mystery occurred to him.
"But why?"
"I have to see the king."
"Oh."
That did not mean much to Jonathan either.
"And I'd like you to go to school while I'm away."
"Would you like that?"
"Yes."
"You're almost 5 years old. Your birthday is next week. You came to us on the first day of the year."
"Where did I come from?"
"From God. All things come from God."
Jonathan knew that was no answer.
"But where was I before?"
he persisted.
"I don't know."
Jonathan frowned. A frown looked funny on such a carefree young face.
"I must have been somewhere."
One day, Philip realized, someone would have to tell Jonathan how babies were born. He grimaced at the thought. Well, this was not the time, happily. He changed the subject. "While I'm away, I want you to learn to count up to 100.
"I can count,"
Jonathan said. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 14, 14.
"Not bad," said Philip. "But Brother Osmond will teach you more. You must sit still in the schoolroom and do everything he tells you to."
"I'm going to be the best in the school," said Jonathan.
"We'll see." Philip studied him for a moment longer. Philip was fascinated by the child's development, the way he learned things and the phases through which he passed. This current insistence on being able to speak Latin or count or run fast was curious. Was it a necessary prelude to real learning? It must serve some purpose in God's plan. And one day Jonathan would be a man. What would he be like then? The thought made Philip impatient for Jonathan to grow up, but that would take as long as the building of the cathedral.
"Give me a kiss then and say goodbye," Philip said.
Jonathan lifted his face, and Philip kissed the soft cheek.
"Goodbye, Father,"
said Jonathan.
"Goodbye, my son,"
Philip said. He gave Johnny Eightpence's arm an affectionate squeeze and went out. The monks were coming out of the crypt and heading for the refectory. Philip went the opposite way and entered the crypt to pray for success on his mission. He had been heartbroken when they told him what had happened at the quarry. 5 people killed, one of them a little girl. He had hidden himself in his house and cried like a child. 5 of his flock struck down by William Hamley and his pack of brutes. Philip had known them all. Harry of Shiring, who had once been Lord Percy's quarryman. Otto Blackface, the dark-skinned man who had been in charge of the quarry since the very beginning. Otto's handsome son Mark. Mark's wife, Alwyn, who played tunes on sheep bells in the evening. And little Norma. Otto's 7-year-old granddaughter, his favorite. Good-hearted, God-fearing, hard-working people, who had a right to expect peace and justice from their lords. William had slaughtered them like a fox killing chickens. It was enough to make the angels weep. Philip had grieved for them, and then he had gone to Shiring to demand justice. The sheriff had refused, point-blank, to take any action. "Lord William has a small army. How should I arrest him?" Sheriff Eustace had said. "The king needs knights to fight against Maud. What will he say if I incarcerate one of his best men? If I brought a charge of murder against William, I'd either be killed immediately by his knights, or hanged for a traitor later by King Stephen." The first casualty of a civil war was justice, Philip had realized. Then the sheriff had told him that William had made a formal complaint about the Kingsbridge market. It was ludicrous, of course, that William could get away with murder and at the same time charge Philip on a technicality, but Philip felt helpless. It was true that he did not have permission to hold a market, and he was in the wrong, strictly speaking. But he could not remain in the wrong. He was the prior of Kingsbridge. All he had was his moral authority. William could call up an army of knights. Bishop Walleran could use his contacts in high places. The sheriff could claim royal authority. But all Philip could do was to say, "This is right, and that is wrong." And if he were to forfeit that position, he really would be helpless. So he had ordered the market to cease. That left him in a truly desperate position. The priory's finances had improved dramatically, thanks to stricter controls on the one hand, and on the other, ever-rising earnings from the market and from sheep farming. But Philip always spent every penny on the building, and he had borrowed heavily from the Jews of Winchester, a loan he had yet to repay. Now, at a stroke, he had lost his supply of cost-free stone, his income from the market had dried up, and his volunteer laborers, many of whom came mainly for the market, were likely to dwindle. He would have to lay off half the builders, and abandon hope of finishing the cathedral in his own lifetime. He was not prepared to do that. He wondered if the crisis was his own fault. Had he been too confident, too ambitious? Sheriff Eustace had said as much. "You're too big for your boots, Philip," he had said angrily. "You run a little monastery and you're a little prior, but you want to rule the bishop and the earl and the sheriff. Well, you can't. We're too powerful for you. All you do is cause trouble." Eustace was an ugly man, with uneven teeth and a cast in one eye, and he was wearing a dirty yellow robe. But unimpressive though he was, his words had stabbed Philip's heart. He was painfully aware that the quarrymen would not have died if he had not made an enemy of William Hamley. But he could not do other than be William's enemy. If he gave up, even more people would suffer, people such as the miller William had killed and the serf's daughter he and his knights had raped. Philip had to fight on, and that meant he had to go to see the king. He hated the idea. He had approached the king once before at Winchester 4 years ago. And although he had got what he wanted, he had been dreadfully ill at ease at the royal court. The king was surrounded by wily and unscrupulous people jostling for his attention and squabbling over his favors, and Philip found such people contemptible. They were trying to acquire wealth and position they did not merit. He did not really understand the game they were playing. In his world, the best way to get something was to deserve it, not to toady to the giver. But now he had no alternative but to enter their world and play their game. Only the king could grant Philip permission to hold a market. Only the king could now save the cathedral. He finished his prayers and left the crypt. The sun was coming up, and there was a pink flush on the grey stone walls of the rising cathedral. The builders, who worked from sunrise to sunset, were just beginning opening their lodges and sharpening their tools and mixing up the first batch of mortar. The loss of the quarry had not yet affected the building. They had always quarried stone faster than they could use it from the beginning, and now they had a stockpile that would last many months. It was time for Philip to leave. All the arrangements were made. The king was at Lincoln. Philip would have a travelling companion, Richard, the brother of Aliena. After fighting for a year as a squire, Richard had been knighted by the king. He had come home to re-equip himself and was now going to rejoin the royal army. Aliena had done astonishingly well as a wool merchant. She no longer sold her wool to Philip, but dealt directly with the Flemish buyers herself. Indeed, this year she had wanted to buy the entire fleece production of the priory. She would have paid less than the Flemish, but Philip would have got the money earlier. He had turned her down. However, it was a measure of her success that she could even make the offer. She was at the stable with her brother now, Philip saw, as he walked across. A crowd had gathered to say goodbye to the travellers. Richard was sitting on a chestnut warhorse that must have cost Aliena 20 pounds. He had grown into a handsome, broad-shouldered young man, his regular features marred only by an angry scar on his right ear. The earlobe had been cut off, no doubt in some fencing accident. He was splendidly dressed in red and green, and outfitted with a new sword, lance, battle-axe, and dagger. His baggage was carried by a second horse, which he had on a leading rein. With him were two men-at-arms on coursers and a squire on a cob. Aliena was in tears, although Philip could not tell whether she was sorry to see her brother go, proud that he looked so fine, or frightened that he might never come back. All three, perhaps. Some of the villagers had come to say goodbye, including most of the young men and boys. No doubt Richard was their hero. All the monks were here, too, to wish their prior a safe journey. The stable hands brought out two horses, a palfrey saddled ready for Philip, and a cob loaded with his modest baggage, mainly food for the journey. The builders put down their tools and came over, led by bearded Tom and his red-headed stepson, Jack. Philip formally embraced Remigius, his sub-prior, and took a warmer farewell of Milius and Cuthbert, then mounted the palfrey. He would be sitting in this hard saddle a long time, he realized grimly. From his raised position he blessed them all. The monks, builders, and villagers waved and called out their goodbyes, as he and Richard rode side by side through the priory gates. They went down the narrow street through the village, waving to people who looked out of their doorways, then clattered across the wooden bridge and onto the road through the fields. A little later, Philip glanced back over his shoulder and saw the rising sun shining through the window space in the half-built east end of the new cathedral. If he failed in his mission, it might never be finished. After all he had been through to get this far, he could not bear to contemplate the idea of defeat now. He turned back and concentrated on the road ahead. Lincoln was a city on a hill. Philip and Richard approached it from the south, on an ancient and busy road called Ermine Street. Even from a distance they could see, at the top of the hill, the towers of the cathedral and the battlements of the castle. But they were still 3 or 4 miles away when, to Philip's astonishment, they came to a city gate. The suburbs must be vast, he thought. The population must run to thousands. At Christmas, the city had been seized by Ranulf of Chester, the most powerful man in the north of England, and a relative of the Empress Maud. King Stephen had since retaken the city, but Ranulf's forces still held the castle. Now, Philip and Richard had learned, as they drew nearer, Lincoln was in the peculiar position of having two rival armies camped within its walls. Philip had not warmed to Richard in their 4 weeks together. Aliena's brother was an angry youth who hated the Hamleys and was set on revenge, and he talked as if Philip felt the same. But there was a difference. Philip hated the Hamleys for what they did to their subjects. Getting rid of them would make the world a better place. Richard could not feel good about himself until he had defeated the Hamleys. His motive was entirely selfish. Richard was physically brave, always ready for a fight, but in other ways he was weak. He confused his men-at-arms by sometimes treating them as equals, and sometimes ordering them around like servants. In taverns he would try to make an impression by buying beer for strangers. He pretended to know the way when he was not really sure, and sometimes led the party far astray because he could not admit that he had made a mistake. By the time they reached Lincoln, Philip knew that Aliena was worth 10 of Richard. They passed a large lake teeming with ships. Then at the foot of the hill they crossed the river that formed the southern boundary of the city proper. Lincoln obviously lived by shipping. Beside the bridge there was a fish market. They went through another guarded gate. Now they left behind the sprawl of the suburbs and entered the teeming city, A narrow, impossibly crowded street ran steeply up the hill directly in front of them. The houses that jostled shoulder to shoulder on either side were made partly or wholly of stone, a sign of considerable wealth. The hill was so steep that most houses had their main floor several feet above ground level at one end, and below the surface at the other. The area underneath the downhill end was invariably a craftsman's workplace or a shop. The only open spaces were the graveyards next to the churches, and on each of these there was a market. Grain, poultry, wool, leather, and others. Philip and Richard, with Richard's small entourage, fought their way through the dense crowd of townspeople, men-at-arms, animals, and carts. Philip realized with astonishment that there were stones beneath his feet. The whole street was paved. What wealth there must be here, he thought, for stones to be laid in the street as if it were a palace or a cathedral. The way was still slippery with refuse and animal dung, but it was much better than the river of mud that constituted most city streets in winter. They reached the crest of the hill and passed through yet another gate. Now they entered the inner city, and the atmosphere was suddenly different, quieter but very tense. Immediately to their left was the entrance to the castle. The great iron-bound door in the archway was shut tight. Dim figures moved behind the arrow-slit windows in the gatehouse, and sentries in armor patrolled the castellated ramparts, the feeble sunshine glinting off their burnished helmets. Philip watched them pacing to and fro. There was no conversation between them, no joshing and laughter, no leaning on the balustrade to whistle at passing girls. They were upright, eagle-eyed, and fearful. To Philip's right, no more than a quarter of a mile from the castle gate, was the west front of the cathedral, and Philip saw instantly that, despite its proximity to the castle, it had been taken over as the king's military headquarters. A line of sentries barred the narrow road that led between the canons' houses to the church. Beyond the sentries, knights and men-at-arms were passing in and out through the three doorways to the cathedral. The graveyard was an army camp, with tents and cooking fires and horses grazing the turf. There were no monastic buildings. Lincoln Cathedral was not run by monks, but by priests called canons, who lived in ordinary townhouses near the church. The space between the cathedral and the castle was empty except for Philip and his companions. Philip suddenly realized that they had the full attention of the guards on the king's side and the sentries on the opposing ramparts. He was in the no-man's land between the two armed camps, probably the most dangerous spot in Lincoln. Looking around, he saw that Richard and the others had already moved on, and he followed them hastily. The king's sentries let them through immediately. Richard was well known. Philip admired the west facade of the cathedral. It had an enormously tall entrance arch and subsidiary arches on either side, half the size of the central one, but still awesome. It looked like the gateway to heaven, which it was, of course, in a way. Philip immediately decided he wanted tall arches in the west front of Kingsbridge Cathedral. Leaving the horses with the squire, Philip and Richard made their way through the encampment and entered the cathedral. It was even more crowded inside than out. The aisles had been turned into stables, and hundreds of horses were tied to the columns of the arcade. Armed men thronged the nave, and here, too, there were cooking fires and bedding. Some spoke English, some French, and a few spoke Flemish, the guttural tongue of the wool merchants of Flanders. By and large, the knights were in here, and the men-at-arms were outside. Philip was sorry to see several men playing at nine men's morris for money, and he was even more disturbed by the appearance of some of the women, who were dressed very skimpily for winter and appeared to be flirting with the men, almost, he thought, as if they were sinful women or even, God forbid, whores. To avoid looking at them, he raised his eyes to the ceiling. It was of wood and beautifully painted in glowing colors, but it was a terrible fire risk with all those people cooking in the nave. He followed Richard through the crowd. Richard seemed at ease here, assured and confident, calling out greetings to barons and lords and slapping knights on the back. The crossing and the east end of the cathedral had been roped off. The east end appeared to have been reserved for the priests. I should think so, too, Philip thought. and the crossing had become the king's quarters. There was another line of guards behind the rope, then a crowd of courtiers, then an inner circle of earls, with King Stephen at the centre on a wooden throne. The king had aged since the last time Philip saw him 5 years ago in Winchester. There were lines of anxiety on his handsome face, and a little grey in his tawny hair, and a year of fighting had made him thinner. He seemed to be having an amiable argument with his earls, disagreeing without anger. Richard went to the edge of the inner circle and made a deep ceremonial bow. The king glanced over, recognized him, and said in a booming voice, "Richard of Kingsbridge, glad to have you back."
"Thank you, my lord king," said Richard.
Philip stepped up beside him and bowed in the same way. Stephen said, "Have you brought a monk as your squire?" All the courtiers laughed.
"This is the prior of Kingsbridge, lord," said Richard.
Stephen looked again, and Philip saw the light of recognition in his eye.
"Of course, I know Prior Philip," he said,
but his tone was not as warm as when he greeted Richard. "Have you come to fight for me?" The courtiers laughed again. Philip was pleased the king had remembered his name.
"I'm here because God's work of rebuilding Kingsbridge Cathedral needs urgent help from my lord king."
"I must hear all about it,"
Stephen interrupted hastily.
"Come and see me tomorrow when I'll have more time."
He turned back to the earls, and resumed his conversation in a lower voice. Richard bowed and withdrew, and Philip did the same. Philip did not speak to King Stephen on the following day, nor the day after, nor the day after that. On the first night he stayed at an alehouse, but he felt oppressed by the constant smell of roasting meat and the laughter of loose women. Unfortunately, there was no monastery in the town. Normally, the bishop would have offered him accommodation, but the king was living in the bishop's palace, and all the houses around the cathedral were crammed full with members of Stephen's entourage. On the second night, Philip went right outside the town, beyond the suburb of Wigford, where there was a monastery that ran a home for lepers. There he got horse bread and weak beer for supper, a hard mattress on the floor, silence from sundown to midnight, services in the small hours of the morning, and a breakfast of thin porridge without salt, and he was happy. He went to the cathedral early every morning, carrying the precious charter that gave the priory the right to take stone from the quarry. Day after day the king failed to notice him. When the other petitioners talked among themselves, discussing who was in favour and who was out, Philip remained aloof. He knew why he was being kept waiting. The entire church was at odds with the king. Stephen had not kept the generous promises that had been extracted from him at the start of his reign. He had made an enemy of his brother, the wily Bishop Henry of Winchester, by supporting someone else for the job of Archbishop of Canterbury, a move which had also disappointed Waller and Bigod, who wanted to rise on Henry's coattails. But Stephen's greatest sin in the eyes of the church had been to arrest Bishop Roger of Salisbury and Roger's two nephews, who were bishops of Lincoln and Ely, all on one day, on charges of unlicensed castle building. A chorus of outrage had gone up from cathedrals and monasteries all over the country at this act of sacrilege. Stephen was hurt. As men of God, the bishops had no need of castles, he said, and if they built castles, they could not expect to be treated purely as men of God. He was sincere, but naive. The split had been patched up, but King Stephen was no longer eager to hear the petitions of holy men, so Philip had to wait. He used the opportunity to meditate. It was something he had little time for as prior, and he missed it. Now suddenly he had nothing to do for hours on end, and he spent the time lost in thought. Eventually the other courtiers left a space around him, making him quite conspicuous, and it must have been increasingly difficult for Stephen to ignore him. He was deep in contemplation of the sublime mystery of the Trinity on the morning of his seventh day in Lincoln, when he realized that someone was standing right in front of him, looking at him and speaking to him, and that person was the king.
"Are you asleep with your eyes open, man?"
Stephen was saying in a tone halfway between amusement and irritation.
"I'm sorry, lord. I was thinking," Philip said, and bowed belatedly. "Never mind. I want to borrow your clothes.
What? Philip was too surprised to mind his manners. I want to take a look around the castle, and if I'm dressed as a monk, they won't shoot arrows at me. Come on, go into one of the chapels and take off your robe.
Philip had only an undershirt on beneath his robe.
But, Lord, what shall I wear?
I forget how modest you monks are.
Stephen clicked his fingers at a young knight. Robert, lend me your tunic, quick. The knight, who was talking to a girl, took off his tunic with a swift motion, gave it to the king with a bow, then made a vulgar gesture to the girl. His friends laughed and cheered. King Stephen gave the tunic to Philip. Philip slipped into the tiny chapel of St. Dunstan, asked the saint's pardon with a hasty prayer, then took off his habit and put on the knight's short-skirted scarlet tunic. It seemed very strange indeed. He had been wearing monastic clothing since the age of 6, and he could not have felt more odd if he had been dressed as a woman. He emerged and handed his monkish robe to Stephen, who pulled it over his head swiftly. Then the king astonished him by saying, "Come with me if you like. You can tell me about Kingsbridge Cathedral." Philip was taken aback. His first instinct was to refuse. A sentry on the castle ramparts might be tempted to take a shot at him, and he would not be protected by religious garments. But he was being offered an opportunity to be totally alone with the king, with plenty of time to explain about the quarry and the market. He might never get another chance like this. Stephen picked up his own cloak, which was purple with white fur at the collar and hem. "Wear this," he said to Philip. "You draw their fire away from me." The other courtiers had gone quiet, watching, wondering what would happen. The king was making a point, Philip realized. He was saying that Philip had no business here in an armed camp, and could not expect to be granted privileges at the expense of men who risked their lives for the king. This was not unfair, but Philip knew that if he accepted this point of view, he might as well go home and give up all hope of repossessing the quarry or reopening the market. He had to accept the challenge. He drew a deep breath and said, "Perhaps it is God's will that I should die to save the king." Then he took the purple cloak and put it on. There was a murmur of surprise from the crowd, and King Stephen himself looked quite startled. Everyone had expected Philip to back down. Almost immediately he wished he had, but he had committed himself now. Stephen turned and walked toward the north door. Philip followed him. Several courtiers made to go with them, but Stephen waved them back, saying, "Even a monk might attract suspicion if he is attended by the entire royal court." He pulled the cowl of Philip's robe over his head, and they passed out into the graveyard. Philip's costly cloak drew curious glances as they picked their way across the campsite. Men assumed he was a baron, and were puzzled not to recognize him. The glances made him feel guilty, as if he were some kind of impostor. Nobody looked at Stephen. They did not go directly to the main gate of the castle, but made their way through a maze of narrow lanes and came out by the church of St. Paul in the Bale, across from the northeast corner of the castle. The castle walls were built on top of massive earth ramparts and surrounded by a dry moat. There was a swath of open space 50 yards wide between the edge of the moat and the nearest buildings. Stephen stepped onto the grass and began to walk west, studying the north wall of the castle, staying close to the backs of the houses on the outer rim of the cleared area. Philip went with him. Stephen made Philip walk on his left, between him and the castle. The open space was there to give bowmen a clear shot at anyone who approached the walls, of course. Philip was not afraid to die, but he was afraid of pain, and the thought uppermost in his mind was how much an arrow would hurt.
"Scared, Philip?" said Stephen. "Terrified," Philip replied candidly, and then, made reckless by fear, he added cheekily, "How about you?"
The king laughed at his nerve.
"A little," he admitted.
Philip remembered that this was his chance to talk about the cathedral, but he could not concentrate while his life was in such peril. His eyes went constantly to the castle, and he raked the ramparts, watching for a man drawing a bow. The castle occupied the entire southwest corner of the inner city, its west wall being part of the city wall, so to walk all the way around it one had to go out of the city. Stephen led Philip through the west gate, and they passed out into the suburb called Newland. Here the houses were like peasant hovels, made of wattle and daub, with large gardens, such as village houses had. A bitter, cold wind whipped across the open fields beyond the houses. Stephen turned south, still skirting the castle. He pointed to a little door in the castle wall. "That's where Ranulf of Chester sneaked out to make his escape when I took the city, I suspect," he said. Philip was less frightened here. There were other people on the pathway, and the ramparts on this side were less heavily guarded, for the occupants of the castle were afraid of an attack from the city, not from the countryside. Philip took a deep breath and then blurted out, "If I am killed, will you give Kingsbridge a market and make William Hamley give back the quarry?" Stephen did not answer immediately. They walked downhill to the southwest corner of the castle and looked up at the keep. From their position it appeared loftily impregnable. Just below that corner they turned into another gateway, and entered the lower city to walk along the castle's south side. Philip felt in danger again. It would not be too difficult for someone inside the castle to deduce that the two men who were making a circuit of the walls must be on a scouting expedition, and therefore they were fair game, especially the one in the purple cloak. To distract himself from his fear, he studied the keep. There were small holes in the wall which served as outlets for the latrines, and the refuse and filth which was washed out simply fell on the walls and the mound below, and stayed there until it rotted away. No wonder there was a stink. Philip tried not to breathe too deeply, and they hurried past. There was another smaller tower at the southeast corner. Now Philip and Stephen had walked around three sides of the square. Philip wondered if Stephen had forgotten his question. He was apprehensive about asking it again. The king might feel he was being pushed and take offence. They reached the main street that went through the middle of the town and turned again, but before Philip had time to feel relieved, they passed through another gate into the inner city, and a few moments later they were in the no-man's land between cathedral and castle. To Philip's horror, the king stopped there. He turned to talk to Philip, positioning himself in such a way that he could scrutinize the castle over Philip's shoulder. Philip's vulnerable back, clad in ermine and purple, was exposed to the gatehouse, which was bristling with sentries and archers. He went as stiff as a statue, expecting an arrow or a spear in his back at any moment. He began to perspire, despite the freezing cold wind. "I gave you that quarry years ago, didn't I?" said King Stephen. "Not exactly," Philip replied through gritted teeth. "You gave us the right to take stone for the cathedral, but you gave the quarry to Percy Hamley. Now Percy's son William has thrown out my stone-cutters, killing five people, including a woman and a child, and he refuses us access. He shouldn't do things like that, especially if he wants me to make him Earl of Shiring," Stephen said thoughtfully. Philip was encouraged, but a moment later the king said, "I'm damned if I can see a way to get into this castle." "Please make William reopen the quarry," Philip said. "He is defying you and stealing from God." Stephen seemed not to hear. "I don't think they've got many men in there," he said in the same musing tone. "I suspect nearly all of them are on the ramparts to make a show of strength. What was that about the market?" That was all part of the test, Philip decided, making him stand out in the open with his back to a host of archers. He wiped his brow with the fur cuff of the king's cloak. "My lord king, every Sunday people come from all over the county to worship at Kingsbridge and labour, for no wages, on the cathedral building site. When we first began, a few enterprising men and women would come to the site and sell meat pies and wine and hats and knives to the volunteer workers. So gradually a market grew up, and now I am asking you to license it." "Will you pay for your license?" A payment was normal, Philip knew, but he also knew that it might be waived for a religious body. "Yes, Lord, I will pay, unless you would wish to give us the license without payment, for the greater glory of God." Stephen looked directly into Philip's eyes for the first time. "You're a brave man, to stand there,
with the enemy behind you and bargain with me.
Philip gave back an equally frank stare. If God decides my life is over, nothing can save me, he said, sounding braver than he felt. But if God wants me to live on and build Kingsbridge Cathedral, 10,000 archers cannot strike me down.
Well said, Stephen remarked,
and clapping a hand on Philip's shoulder, he turned toward the cathedral. Weak with relief, Philip walked beside him, feeling better for every step away from the castle. He seemed to have passed the test, but it was important to get an unambiguous commitment from the king. Any moment now he would be engulfed by courtiers again. As they passed through the line of sentries, Philip took his courage in both hands and said, "My lord king, if you would write a letter to the sheriff of Shiring." He was interrupted. One of the earls rushed up, looking flustered, and said, "Robert of Gloucester is on his way here, my lord king."
"What? How far away?"
"Close. A day at most."
"Why haven't I been warned? I posted men all around."
"They came by the Foss Way, then turned off the road to approach across open country."
"Who is with him?"
"All the earls and knights on his side who have lost their lands in the last 2 years. Ranulph of Chester is also with him."
"Of course. Treacherous dog.
He has brought all his knights from Chester, plus a horde of wild, rapacious Welshmen. How many men altogether?"
"About 1,000.
"Damn.
That's 100 more than we have."
By this time several barons had gathered around, and now another one spoke. "Lord, if he's coming across open country, he'll have to cross the river at the ford."
"Good thinking, Edward," Stephen said. "Take your men down to that ford and see if you can hold it. You'll need archers, too."
"How far are they now? Does anybody know?" asked Edward.
The first earl said, "Very close," the scout said. "They could reach the ford before you."
"I'll go right away," Edward said.
"Good man,"
said King Stephen. He made a fist with his right hand and punched his left palm. "I shall meet Robert of Gloucester on the battlefield at last. I wish I had more men. Still, an advantage of 100 men isn't much." Philip listened to it all in grim silence. He was sure he had been on the point of getting Stephen's agreement. Now the king's mind was elsewhere. But Philip was not ready to give up. He was still wearing the king's purple robe. He slipped it off his shoulders and held it out, saying, "Perhaps we should both revert to type, my lord king." Stephen nodded absently. A courtier stepped behind the king and helped him take off the monkish habit. Philip handed over the royal robe and said, "Lord, you seemed well disposed to my request." Stephen looked irritated to be reminded. He shrugged on his robe and was about to speak when a new voice was heard.
"My lord king!"
Philip recognized the voice. His heart sank. He turned and saw William Hamley.
"William, my boy," said the king,
in the hearty voice he used with fighting men,
"you've arrived just in time."
William bowed and said, "My lord, I've brought 50 knights and 200 men from my earldom." Philip's hopes turned to dust. Stephen was visibly delighted. "What a good man you are," he said warmly. "That gives us the advantage over the enemy." He put his arm around William's shoulders and walked with him into the cathedral. Philip stood where he was and watched them go. He had been agonizingly close to success, but in the end William's army had counted for more than justice, he thought bitterly. The courtier who had helped the king take off the monk's habit now held the robe out to Philip. Philip took it. The courtier followed the king and his entourage into the cathedral. Philip put on his monastic robe. He was deeply disappointed. He looked at the three huge arch doorways of the cathedral. He had hoped to build archways like that at Kingsbridge, but King Stephen had taken the side of William Hamley. The king had been faced with a straight choice, the justice of Philip's case against the advantage of William's army. He had failed his test. Philip was left with only one hope, that King Stephen would be defeated in the forthcoming battle. 2. The bishop said mass in the cathedral when the sky was beginning to change from black to grey. By then the horses were saddled, the knights were wearing their chainmail, the men-at-arms had been fed, and a measure of strong wine had been served to give them all heart. William Hamley knelt in the nave with the other knights and earls, while the war horses stamped and snorted in the aisles, and was forgiven in advance for the killing he would do that day. Fear and excitement made William light-headed. If the king won a victory today, William's name would forever be associated with it, for men would say that he had brought the reinforcements that tipped the balance. If the king should lose, anything could happen. He shivered on the cold stone floor. The king was at the front in a fresh white robe, with a candle in his hand. As the host was elevated, the candle broke and the flame went out. William trembled with dread. It was a bad omen. A priest brought a new candle and took away the broken one, and Stephen smiled nonchalantly, but the feeling of supernatural horror stayed with William, and when he looked around he could tell that others felt the same. After the service the king put on his armor, helped by a valet. He had a knee-length mail coat made of leather with iron rings sewn into it. The coat was slit up to the waist in front and behind, so that he could ride in it. The valet laced it tightly at the throat. He then put on a close-fitting cap with a long mail hood attached, covering his tawny hair and protecting his neck. Over the cap he wore an iron helmet with a nosepiece. His leather boots had mailed trimmings and pointed spurs. As he put on his armor, the earls gathered around him. William followed his mother's advice and acted as if he were already one of them, pushing through the crowd to join the group around the king. After listening for a moment, he realized they were trying to persuade Stephen to withdraw and leave Lincoln to the rebels.
"You hold more territory than Maud. You can raise a larger army," said an older man whom William recognized as Lord Hugh. "Go south, get reinforcements, come back and outnumber them."
After the portent of the broken candle, William almost wished for withdrawal himself, but the king had no time for such talk.
"We're strong enough to defeat them now," he said cheerfully. "Where's your spirit?"
He strapped on a belt with a sword on one side and a dagger on the other, both of them in wood and leather scabbards.
"The armies are too evenly matched," said a tall man with short, grizzled hair and a close-trimmed beard, the Earl of Surrey.
"It's too risky."
This was a poor argument to use with Stephen, William knew. The king was nothing if not chivalrous.
"Too evenly matched?" he repeated scornfully. "I prefer a fair fight."
He pulled on the leather gauntlets with mail on the backs of the fingers. The valet handed him a long wooden shield covered with leather. He hooked its strap around his neck and held it in his left hand.
"We've little to lose by withdrawing at this point," Hugh persisted. "We aren't even in possession of the castle."
"I would lose my chance of meeting Robert of Gloucester on the battlefield," Stephen said.
"For 2 years he's been avoiding me. Now that I have an opportunity to deal with the traitor once and for all, I'm not going to pull out just because we evenly matched."
A groom brought his horse, saddled, ready. As Stephen was about to mount, there was a flurry of activity around the door at the west end of the cathedral, and a knight came running up the nave, muddy and bleeding. William had a doomy premonition that this would be bad news. As the man bowed to the king, William recognized him as one of Edward's men who had been sent to guard the ford.
"We were too late, Lord," the man said hoarsely, breathing hard. "The enemy has crossed the river."
It was another bad sign. William suddenly felt colder. Now there was nothing but open fields between the enemy and Lincoln. Stephen, too, looked struck down for an instant, but he recovered his composure swiftly.
"No matter," he said. "We will meet them all the sooner."
He mounted his war horse. He had a battle axe strapped to his saddle. The valet handed him a wooden lance with a bright iron point, completing his weaponry. Stephen clicked his tongue, and the horse obediently moved forward. As he rode down the nave of the cathedral, the earls, barons, and knights mounted and fell in behind him, and they left the cathedral in procession. In the grounds, the men-at-arms joined them. This was when men began to feel scared and look for a chance to slip away. But their dignified pace and the almost ceremonial atmosphere, with the townspeople looking on, meant it would be very difficult for the faint-hearted to escape. Their numbers were augmented by 100 or more townspeople, fat bakers and short-sighted weavers and red-faced brewers, poorly armoured and riding their cobs and palfreys. Their presence was a sign of the unpopularity of Ranulph. The army could not pass the castle, for they would have been exposed to archery fire from its battlements, so they left the town by the north gate, which was called Newport Arch, and turned west. This was where the battle would be fought. William studied the terrain with a keen eye. Although the hill on the south side of the town sloped steeply to the river, here on the west there was a long ridge which fell gently to the plain. William saw immediately that Stephen had chosen the right spot from which to defend the town, for no matter how the enemy approached, they would always be downhill from the king's army. When Stephen was a quarter of a mile or so out of the city, two scouts came up the slope, riding fast. They spotted the king and went straight to him. William crowded closer to hear their report. "The enemy is approaching fast, lord," said one of the scouts. William looked across the plain. Sure enough, he could see a black mass in the distance, moving slowly toward him. The enemy. He felt a shiver of fear. He shook himself, but the fear persisted. It would go when the fighting started. King Stephen said, "What are their dispositions?" "Ranulph and the Knights of Chester form the middle, lord," the scout began. "They are on foot." William wondered how the scout knew this. He must have gone right into the enemy camp and listened while marching orders were given. That took a cool nerve. "Ranulph in the centre," said Stephen, "as if he were the leader rather than Robert."
"Robert of Gloucester is on his left flank, with an army of men who call themselves the Disinherited," the scout went on. William knew why they used that name. They had all lost lands since the Civil War began.
"Robert has given Ranulph command of the operation, then," Stephen said thoughtfully. "A pity. I know Robert well. I practically grew up with him, and I could guess his tactics. But Ranulph is a stranger to me."
"No matter. Who's on their right?"
"The Welsh, lord."
"Archers, I suppose."
The men of South Wales had a reputation for bowmanship.
"Not these," the scout said. "They are a raving mob, with their faces painted, singing barbaric songs and armed with hammers and clubs. Very few have horses."
"They must be from North Wales," Stephen mused.
"Ranulph has promised them pillage, I expect. God help Lincoln if they get inside the walls. But they won't. What's your name, scout?"
"Roger, called Lackland," the man said.
"Lackland. You shall have 10 acres for this work."
The man was thrilled. "Thank you, lord."
"Now!" Stephen turned and looked at his earls. He was about to make his dispositions. William tensed, wondering what role the king would assign to him.
"Where is my lord Alan of Brittany?"
Alan edged his horse forward. He was the leader of a force of Breton mercenaries, rootless men who fought for pay and whose only loyalty was to themselves. Stephen said to Alan, "I'll have you and your brave Bretons in the front line, on my left." William saw the wisdom of that. Breton mercenaries against Welsh adventurers, the untrustworthy versus the undisciplined.
"William of Ypres,"
Stephen called.
"My lord king."
A dark man on a black warhorse raised his lance. This William was the leader of another force of mercenaries, Flemish men, a shade more reliable than the Bretons, it was said.
Stephen said, "You on my left also, but behind Alan's Bretons."
The two mercenary leaders wheeled about and rode back into the army to organize their men. William wondered where he would be placed. He had no wish to be in the front line. He had already done enough to distinguish himself by bringing his army. A safe, uneventful rearguard position would suit him today. King Stephen said,
"My lords of Worcester, Surrey, Northampton, York, and Hertford, with your knights, form my right flank."
Once again, William saw the sense of Stephen's dispositions. The earls and their knights, mostly mounted, would face Robert of Gloucester and the disinherited nobles who supported him, most of whom would also be on horseback. But William was disappointed not to have been included with the earls. Surely the king could not have forgotten about him.
"I will hold the middle ground, dismounted, with foot soldiers," Stephen said.
For the first time, William disapproved of a decision. It was always better to stay on horseback as long as you could, but Ranulph, at the head of the opposing army, was said to be on foot,
and Stephen's overwrought sense of fair play compelled him to meet his enemy on equal terms. "With me in the centre, I will have William of Shiring and his men," the king said. William did not know whether to be thrilled or terrified. It was a great honour to be chosen to stand with the king. Mother would be gratified. But it put him in the most dangerous position. Worse still, he would be on foot. It also meant the king would be able to see him and judge his performance. He would have to appear fearless and take the fight to the enemy, as opposed to keeping out of trouble and fighting only when forced to, which was the tactic he preferred. "The loyal citizens of Lincoln will bring up the rear," Stephen said. This was a mixture of compassion and military good sense. The citizens would not be much use anywhere, but in the rear they could do little damage and would suffer fewer casualties. William raised the banner of the Earl of Shiring. This was another idea of Mother's. He was not entitled to the banner, strictly speaking, because he was not the Earl. But the men with him were used to following the Shiring banner, or so he would argue if challenged, and by the end of the day, if the battle went well, he might be Earl. His men gathered around him. Walter was by his side, as always, a solid, reassuring presence. So were Ugly Gervaise, Hugh Axe, and Miles Dice. Gilbert, who had died at the quarry, had been replaced by Guillaume de St. Clair, a fresh-faced young man with a vicious streak. Looking around, William was infuriated to see Richard of Kingsbridge wearing bright new armour and riding a splendid warhorse. He was with the Earl of Surrey. He had not brought an army for the king, as William had, but he looked impressive, fresh-faced, vigorous, and brave. And if he did great things today, he might win royal favour. Battles were unpredictable, and so were kings. On the other hand, perhaps Richard would be killed today. What a stroke of luck that would be. William lusted for it more than he had ever lusted for a woman. He looked to the west. The enemy was closer. Philip was on the roof of the cathedral, and he could see Lincoln laid out like a map. The old city surrounded the cathedral on the hilltop. It had straight streets and neat gardens and the castle in the southwest corner. The newer part, noisy and overcrowded, occupied the steep hillside to the south, between the old city and the River Witham. This district was normally bustling with commercial activity, but today it was covered with a fearful silence like a pall, and the people were standing on their rooftops to watch the battle. The river came in from the east, ran along the foot of the hill, then widened into a big natural harbour called Brayfield Pool, which was surrounded by quays and full of ships and boats. A canal called the Fosdyke ran west from Brayfield Pool, all the way to the River Trent, Philip had been told. Seeing it from a height, Philip marvelled at how it ran straight for miles. People said it had been built in ancient times. The canal formed the edge of the battlefield. Philip watched King Stephen's army march out of the city in a ragged crowd, and slowly form up in three orderly columns on the ridge. Philip knew that Stephen had placed the earls on his right, for they were the most colourful, with their tunics of red and yellow and their bright banners. They were also the most active, riding up and down, giving orders and holding consultations and making plans. The group to the king's left, on the slope of the ridge that went down to the canal, were dressed in dull grey and brown, had fewer horses, and were less busy, conserving their energies. They would be the mercenaries. Beyond Stephen's army, where the line of the canal became indistinct and merged with the hedgerows, the rebel army covered the field like a swarm of bees. At first, they had appeared to be stationary. Then, when he looked again after a while, they were closer. And now, if he concentrated, he could just discern their motion. He wondered how strong they were. All indications were that the two sides were evenly matched. There was nothing Philip could do to influence the outcome, a situation he hated. He tried to quiet his spirit and be fatalistic. If God wanted a new cathedral at Kingsbridge, he would cause Robert of Gloucester to defeat King Stephen today, so that Philip could ask the victorious Empress Maud to let him repossess the quarry and reopen the market. And if Stephen should defeat Robert, Philip would have to accept God's will, give up his ambitious plans, and let Kingsbridge once more decline into sleepy obscurity. Try as he might, Philip could not think that way.
He wanted Robert to win. A strong wind buffeted the towers of the cathedral and threatened to blow the more frail spectators off the leads and hurl them to the graveyard below. The wind was bitterly cold. Philip shivered and pulled his cloak tighter around him. The two armies were now about a mile apart. The rebel army halted when it was about a mile from the king's front line. It was tantalizing to be able to see their mass, but not make out any details. William wanted to know how well armed they were, whether they were cheerful and aggressive or tired and reluctant, even how tall they were. They continued to advance at a slow creep, as those in the rear, motivated by the same anxiety that William was suffering, pressed forward to get a look at the enemy. In Stephen's army, the earls and their knights lined up on their horses with their lances at the ready, as if they were at a tournament and about to begin the jousting. William reluctantly sent all the horses in his contingent to the rear. He told the squires not to go back to the city, but to hold the horses there in case they were needed. For flight, he meant, although he did not say so. If a battle was lost, it was better to run than die. There was a lull when it seemed as if the fighting would never begin. The wind dropped, and the horses calmed down, although the men did not. King Stephen took off his helmet and scratched his head. William became fretful. Fighting was all right, but thinking about it made him feel nauseated. Then, for no apparent reason, the atmosphere became tense again. A battle cry went up from somewhere. All the horses suddenly turned skittish. A cheer began and was drowned almost instantly by the thunder of hooves. The battle was on. William smelled the sour, sweaty odor of fear. He looked around, trying desperately to figure out what was happening, but all was confusion, and being on foot, he could see only his immediate surroundings. The earls on the right seemed to have started the battle by charging the enemy. Presumably, the forces opposite them, Earl Robert's army of disinherited nobles, were responding in like manner, charging in formation. Almost immediately a cry went up from the left, and William turned to see that the mounted men among the Breton mercenaries were spurring their horses forward. At that, a blood-curdling cacophony arose from the corresponding section of the enemy army, the Welsh mob, presumably. He could not see who had the advantage. He had lost sight of Richard. Dozens of arrows rose like a flock of birds from behind the enemy lines and began to fall all around. William held his shield over his head. He loathed arrows. They killed at random. King Stephen roared a war cry and charged. William drew his sword and ran forward, calling his men to follow. But the horsemen on his left and right had fanned out as they charged forward, and they came between him and the enemy. On his right, there was a deafening clash of iron on iron, and the air filled with a metallic smell he knew well. The earls and the disinherited had joined battle. All he could see was men and horses colliding, wheeling, charging, and falling. The neighing of the beasts was indistinguishable from the men's battle cries, and somewhere in that noise William could already hear the bone-chilling, dreadful screams of wounded men in agony. He hoped Richard was one of those screaming. William looked left and was horrified to see that the Bretons were falling back before the clubs and axes of the wild Welsh tribesmen. The Welsh were berserk, yelling and screaming and trampling one another in their eagerness to get at the enemy. Perhaps they were greedy to loot the rich city. The Bretons, with nothing more than the prospect of another week's pay to spur them on, were fighting defensively and giving ground. William was disgusted. He was frustrated that he had not yet struck a single blow. He was surrounded by his knights, and ahead of him were the horses of the earls and the Bretons. He pushed forward, slightly ahead and to one side of the king. There was combat all around, fallen horses, men fighting hand to hand with the ferocity of cats, the deafening ring of swords, and the sickly smell of blood. But William and King Stephen were, for the moment, stuck in a dead zone. Philip could see everything, but he understood nothing. He had no idea what was going on. All was confusion, flashing blades, charging horses, banners, flying and falling, and the sounds of battle carried on the wind, muted by distance. It was maddeningly frustrating. Some men fell and died, others overcame and fought on, but he could not tell who was winning and who losing. A cathedral priest standing nearby in a fur coat looked at Philip and said,
What's going on?
Philip shook his head and said, I can't tell. But even as he spoke, he discerned a movement.